Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Howard Rheingold.
Thank you.
Howard Rheingold is a critic, writer, futurist, and teacher, specializing in the cultural, social, and political implications of modern communication media, such as the internet, mobile telephony, and virtual communities, a term he is credited with inventing. Howard was the founding executive editor of Hotwired, the successful commercial webzine launched by Wired magazine in 1994. For more than 20 years, Howard has been on the leading edge of the cyberspace revolution as a participant and an observer. His forecasts, advice, warnings, and dreams have been shared with audiences around the world. While knowledgeable about the technical and commercial possibilities of these merging communications media, Howard is especially interested in the human and the policy issues that inevitably result from the adoption of new inventions. He has a proven track record of being able to identify the way that our lives, businesses, and institutions are going to change tomorrow as the result of technologies that are emerging today. Howard is a visiting lecturer in Stanford University's Department of Communication, a lecturer in UC Berkeley's School of Information, and a frequent contributor to the DML Central blog on topics ranging from new media literacy to learning innovation. Please visit www.rheingold.com for an extensive archive of his work. Howard's presentation today is based on his new book, NetSmart, How to Thrive Online. Please welcome Howard Rheingold.
Thank you, a double welcome. It's great to see a full house. There's nothing more pathetic than a book talk where my blood relatives outnumber everybody else. And that has happened to me. And I see a lot of familiar faces. Thank you, my friends, for coming. And I see a lot of faces I don't recognize. So thank you for coming. This is a great balance of daunting and comforting. So if you are concerned, as I think we all are, that our use of digital media, what are now called social media, are making us as individuals or our entire society shallow, then why not teach more people how to swim so we can all explore the deep end of the pool? The way you use a search engine, stream video from your smartphone, update your Facebook status matters to you and to me and to all of us, because these are not just keys to individual success today, but the way we use these media today are going to influence the way they are used and misused for decades to come. Very recently, we've seen some strong critiques of the impacts, the side effects, and the perhaps hidden costs of our use of everything from smartphones to the web. And I pay close attention to those, particularly the ones that are based on evidence rather than just opinion. And I think it's important for us to always think critically about our use of technology, particularly our social media practices, which take up so much of our lives these days. Critique, while necessary, I don't think it is sufficient. Knowing that something is broken or that it costs more than you thought it would is necessary, but it's not always going to give you the information that you might need to fix it, to repair it, or to ameliorate it. So instead of confining myself to questions such as, is Google making us stupid? Is Facebook commoditizing our privacy? Is Twitter chopping our attention into micro slices? Which are all good questions to explore. I've been thinking more broadly about how to use social media intelligently, humanely, and, as I've discovered, above all, mindfully. So I've turned to my own experience in a way that I have not in my previous books, nearly 30 years online, but I've also done the kind of research that I think is necessary if you're going to make factual claims. I want to back those up with evidence. And I've talked to many of the people who have become successful in using media, names that many of you would recognize, like Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia, or sociologist Dana Boyd, or gamester Jane McGonigal, many of these who have spoken here at the Commonwealth Club. And Annette Smart is about what I've learned in these years. And what I've learned and what I want to pass along to people, to try to increase the level of cluefulness in the world about our use of these media, is that there are five essential literacies that I think everybody ought to know something about, starting with attention and then continuing to participation, collaboration, crap detection, and network know-how. I'm going to briefly go through each of those tonight. I get into a lot more detail in the book, but I want to give you something to take away from this that you're going to find useful. I want to start with attention, because not only is it, I think, an acute problem that we all recognize, that social media have really confronted us with, but I think it's also the building block of thought and communication. Many of you may have seen the video that was taken from a mall security camera of the young woman. These are stills from that video of a young woman who walked into a fountain in a mall while she was texting. In the Pew Internet and American Life study, who do very good scientific research, have found that 1 in 6 Americans have admitted to bumping into something or somebody while texting. And of course, we've all had the terrifying experience, if you haven't had it yet, you will, of driving down the freeway and noticing that the person in the automobile next to you at 60 or 70 miles per hour is texting while they're driving. If you are a professor or a student, you know that classrooms have changed dramatically. If you are standing in front of the group, unlike tonight, many of the people that you are facing are not looking at you. They're looking at their laptops. This is from one of the first classes that I taught before I learned to put the chairs in a circle. And I realized then that the students didn't know what it looked like from where I stood. So with their permission, I took a little video of them. And then with their permission, I put it on YouTube. I projected it the next time I came to class. And I had a camera at the back of the room while I was projecting it. And you'll notice this one student here, for some reason, instead of watching the screen in the front of the room, he decided to watch the video on his laptop. And then, for some reason, he decided he was going to go explore my website. And then as the camera pulled away, it caught him going back to checking his email. Now, the interesting thing about this student that really got me to thinking about this attention business is that he was an excellent student, one of the very rare A-plus students. Years go by without an A-plus student, and I'm pretty sure that if I had stopped him at that moment and said, what am I talking about, he would have been able to tell me. So you may be familiar with a lot of the publicity recently about research that has been done by Cliff Nass at Stanford on media multitasking, who's done a very, very good job doing good empirical research that demonstrates pretty definitively that 95% of the people who are multitasking are actually degrading their performance at the component task rather than becoming more efficient at it. And I wondered, was this young man one of those 5%? And this is the important question. Was he born that way? Where some people can run faster or jump higher? Or did he learn something? Did he stumble on something that we might be able to learn, we might be able to teach people? And that really got me thinking about training attention. And I started working on it with myself and with my students. And one of the things that we discovered was that attention to attention, simply becoming aware of where your attention is being deployed, is not just the first step. In some senses, it's the whole ball game. And so mindfulness is a very old tradition. If it sounds a little spiritual to you and you want something more scientific, you can use metacognition. They mean more or less the same thing, although metacognition is I think, expanded from mindfulness has to do with being fully aware of the contents of your consciousness. I think we've all had the experience of you drive a familiar route and you find yourself home and you don't remember what happened at all. A lot of us go through the day in that state of consciousness. So mindfulness of how you're deploying attention simply has to do with knowing where your attention is at any moment. With my students, I ask my students to co-teach with me, and one of the tasks of the co-teaching team is to come up with an attention probe that helps us become, at least for a moment, a little bit more mindful of what we're doing with our attention. So, for example, one team came up with the idea of ringing a chime at random intervals, and then we would write on a yellow post-it note what we were thinking, if it was directly related to what was being discussed, on an orange post-it note if it was tangentially related to what was being discussed, and on a red post-it note if it had nothing at all to do with what was being discussed, and then anonymously, and then we would put them all up on the whiteboard, and it would give you a kind of an instant picture of where people's attention was. Another co-teaching team did something that turned out to be kind of hard to do, which was everyone in the class, including me, because I was being one of the students while the co-teaching team was up, whenever one of the co-teaching team put a writing implement in her left hand, we were to put our thumb on the table. And it turns out to be kind of difficult to do that. We came up with a lot of attention probes, but the idea here is that anybody can really start paying attention to where their attention is. And I started thinking about this in particular about information, our attention to information while we're sitting there in front of the screen for hours a day. And I'm started calling that infotension. I've started working on ways of helping people learn how to do it. And we all need to make decisions. We all click on those cute cat videos. There wouldn't be cute cat videos if people didn't just click on them instead of whatever else it was that they were supposed to be doing. We need to make decisions about whether we're going to pay attention to something, or we're maybe going to open a tab for it because we want to pay attention to it later, or we're going to tag it and bookmark it because we think it's important and something that we and other people might want to pay attention to. So the objective of part of this training is to simply become conscious of those decisions. And of course, you need to make conscious decisions in light of what your priorities are, and only you know what your priorities are, and your priorities change from day to day and hour to hour. So I came up with a set of steps. I learned some of this from B.J. Fogg, professor at Stanford, who's working on how to develop new habits. And he has this very simple and fairly well-proven three-step plan, which is to start with something very simple and easy, then find a place for it, and then repeat. And you've got, after a while, you've got a new habit. So I'm talking about spatial arrangements, visible goals, and starting small and cultivating habits. So what I mean when I'm talking to my students about spatial arrangements is that many people use a dashboard of some kind. This is called NetVibes, and it's a way that I can have a stream of information about the topics that I'm interested in that come in through what are called RSS feeds. I'm sure that some of you are familiar with that. And searches. It's a way of honing in what you're interested in and then having that latest information come to you as soon as it's published. And the way I like to use this dashboard is that it has three levels of abstraction. So you can have a different dashboard for different subjects. And on each dashboard, you've got these tabs. And the tabs you can drag and drop. And really that has to do with matching the visual tool set to my attentional strategy. So attentional strategy really comes from what do I want to do today? So I simply write down, using the old right brain, handwriting and piece of paper, two or three goals for the day in a few words. You can see I've got six words here at the beginning of this particular day. What does it take? Maybe 10 seconds to do that. It's a way of starting simple and easy. And I put that piece of paper on the periphery of my vision. This is actually next to the screen on my right. So like many people, I have multiple screens in front of me. And every once in a while, my gaze will fall on that piece of paper. And when it does, I simply ask myself, where is my attention right now? And how does that relate to where I want to get by the end of the day? And, you know, some days the objective is just learn stuff. And so I will follow those links and those trails wherever they go. And some days I wouldn't have been able to finish this book if I didn't get a certain amount done every day, no matter what else was happening. So these tabs here, depending on what my priority is for the day, I drag the most relevant ones to the left and the less relevant ones to the right. So there are days in which I'm only going to look at the leftmost tab, if any at all, and there are days when I can feel free to explore. And also, so the next level are feeds. So each of these is a feed of information from a blog or from a Twitter search or from a news search. And I put the, you don't see the whole screen here, but I put the ones that are the most important to me at the top. So we're all used to reading from the left to the right and top to bottom. So it's kind of easy for me to know, is this a day when I'm just looking at the top left or is this a day when I range throughout the whole thing? So it doesn't really matter whether you use this kind of dashboard or not, but I think trying to match the way you arrange your information on the screen with your attentional priorities and paying attention every once in a while to what you're doing and what those priorities are is a way that you can begin to develop infotension. So I get into a lot more detail about this in the book. And I've got a lot of footnotes that you can check out if you want to find out the evidence behind the claims that I make there. But first of all, attention can be trained. Contemplative traditions have claimed this for a very long time. There's a lot of good neuroscience about it these days, and I've put a lot of the references to some of the better books and studies in the book. The Mindful Brain, for example, comes to mind. There's a lot of research on reading, which I think is very relevant to this. Breathe. A friend of mine by the name of Linda Stone taught me this. She noticed that she was holding her breath while she was doing her email. So she began asking her friends to notice whether they held their breath while they're doing their email. And you should try this because people do it. And what that has to do with, she theorizes, and I agree, is that the fight or flight response. So our primordial ancestors were walking through the savanna and they heard a sound. They needed to stop and hold their breath and figure out whether this was something that was going to eat them and they needed to run or prepare to fight, or something that they could eat and they needed to prepare to run and maybe to fight. And while they're holding their breath, their adrenaline is pumping and a lot of their endocrine system is preparing them for a lot of physical activity. And this is very good if you want to save your life in the next 15 seconds. Turns out to be not so good for you in the long run if you do this often every day. And of course, we're not really being chased by saber-tooth anything 500 times a day. So just noticing how you're breathing and taking a breath, again, really simple steps, is something that you can positively do that doesn't take a lot of energy, that can change your relationship to your infotension. Attention to intention is how the mind changes the brain. I didn't really come up with this. It is really solid neuroscience. Donald Hebb, who's sort of the father of neural networks, many years ago said, neurons that fire together wire together. What he meant by that is that when you have particular thoughts or particular images and you concentrate on them, then complex networks of nerve cells fire together, begin to coordinate together. And the more you do that, the more they fire together. And very recently, in the last week or so, I've seen research that shows that nerve cells develop that are repeatedly fired this way, begin to develop little growths on them that make stronger connections with other nerve cells. So by becoming aware of how you are deploying your awareness, you're beginning to change your brain to become more aware of how you're deploying your awareness. So I want to talk about critical consumption. That's the more polite name for it. But when I started studying this, I came across Ernest Hemingway's quote that every journalist needs to have an infallible internal crap detector. I really started thinking about this quite a number of years ago when my daughter, who is now grown, there is a seat up here if you're looking for a seat. She came of age about the same time that search engines did. She started doing her research for her papers in middle school. Before Google, it was InfoSeek and AltaVista. And I sat down with her and talked with her about, I think, the most important facts of life online these days. I said, you know, you can go to your library and get a book out, and you might disagree with that book. And there's always a chance that it's wrong. But you can be sure that there was an author and an editor and a publisher who probably checked if you said George Washington was born in 17-something, that was actually the case. You put a term into a search engine, it's really magic. It's actual magic. It's a magical spell. You can put the right words together. You can get the answer to any question in a couple of seconds, anywhere you are. You need to know how to compose that spell, but it's now up to you, not the publisher of the information, to guarantee or to determine the validity of that information. So this was an exercise that I did with her. I said, put Martin Luther King Jr.'s name in a search engine. And you'll notice this is fairly recent on Google. It's the third one down. Also, it's on the first page of Bing and Yahoo. Martin Luther King Jr., a true historical examination, martinlutherking.org. And so I said, click on that, take a look at it. So it's a website about the civil rights leader, and you can look at an article, and the more you read, the more you see that it has a pretty radical negative view of Martin Luther King Jr. And so she said, how do I know whether this is true or not? And I said, well, you can start by looking up the author, and there is an author's name, and putting that name in the search engine is informative about what that author's point of view happens to be. But we couldn't find an author for the entire website. So I showed her a utility called Whois. It's been part of the internet forever. You can use Whois, you can put in a URL, and it will tell you who the registered owner of that website is. So put in the URL for martinlutherking.org, and you find out that someone by the name of Don Black at stormfront.org is responsible for it. And so you search on stormfront.org, and according to Wikipedia, it's a white nationalist and supremacist neo-Nazi internet forum. This is what's known as a cloaked website. And this is been used as an example for so many years. I mean, I started using this, I guess, 12 years ago, that they've come out of the closet about it, and they actually put who they are on the front page of it. But it's a good example. And I've collected examples of this. I have dozens, if not scores of examples. This one would be, it's a little funny, and it's a little frightening. And it was more frightening when I first discovered it a few years ago because they did not give you the clues that they give you now. But notice that, so this is the free online pregnancy tester. You enter your name and start pregnancy test. And when you click it, a little flash comes up and says, sit still while we scan you. So we immediately know this is a joke. But you know, there are a certain number of pregnancies caused every year by people who aren't entirely clear on the concept of where babies come from. So it's maybe a little bit scary, though. So, of course, I put in the name Joe. And congratulations, Joe, you're with child. A remote testing system has detected that you're pregnant. The miracle of life has begun. To see whether your baby is a boy or a girl, click the View My Baby button below. Notice it's got real ads for pregnancy tests here. So I couldn't help but check it out, and it turns out it's a girl. So, you know, progressively, it's pretty obvious that this is a joke, but I couldn't resist the next one, Who's the Daddy? If you don't like the daddy, you can pick another daddy. Anthem. So here's First Genetics, very nicely designed website. One of the things that I told my daughter is if you see a website that claims to be a scientific institute and it's very badly designed, and maybe that's a clue. But if it's well designed, don't use that as a clue that it's legitimate. This is a scientific enterprise in England that has developed a primate, a mandrill, who can understand English and reply via teletype. Completely bogus. Many teachers are beginning to use this. This is the endangered Pacific Northwest tree octopus, a completely non-existent species. And this is the link here for my collection of these sites. There's a lot more. I could go on for an hour with these here. So again, the book gets into a lot more detail about this. And I think crap detection is particularly important. We're talking about medical information, we're talking about political information. A lot is at stake. Who does not Google their symptoms? Who, when they get a disease, does not look online for information about that? You could find out information that your doctor doesn't know yet that could save your life. Or you could kill yourself. So, rules of thumb. Again, think like a detective. Again, this started with talking to my daughter about this. Don't assume anything is accurate. Start looking for clues to whether you should turn your credibility meter up or you should turn your credibility meter down about a website. Search to learn. We're used to searching and finding the answer. A lot of times you just want to know where's the nearest pizza place. But if I'm talking to a student and it's about learning something, don't stop with one search engine. Don't stop with the first page of results. Use the snippets of information that you get when you search to refine your search. And don't stop with one or two searches. Continue a little bit. Explore a little bit. Look for authors. Search on their names. So there are a lot of sophisticated techniques, and there are websites for finding out these scholarly or scientific credentials of somebody. But really, simply looking at who claims to be responsible for this and what does a search of their name turn out is really simple and can be quite powerful. Triangulation is something that good journalists do, which is to try to find three independent sources before you pass along a report. So I was online and hanging out on Twitter the night that the rumor came across that Egypt had shut down its internet, which comes under the category of interesting if true. I wasn't about to pass that information along to people who were paying attention to me until I could find some other sources about it. So I put out a request to my network. Does anybody know how I can verify this? I looked on BBC, CNN, Al Jazeera, nothing about it. So that made me suspicious. One person told me about someone who was online at that moment who was talking to someone in Egypt. And I happened to know that that person was involved in making a Middle East translation service. So that person verified that, in fact, they were being told that that was true by somebody in Egypt. Somebody reminded me of another internet utility called Ping that enables you to find out whether a website is alive. So I asked people for some websites in Egypt, and all of them were unavailable. And then there was another report from a blog, and several people pointed me to different blogs, but all those blogs led back to one. So I wouldn't believe that blog by itself, but I had three pieces of evidence. I did pass it along, and it turned out to be accurate. However, not too long after that was the earthquake in Haiti. And you might remember that there were rumors immediately afterwards that if you texted a certain telephone number, that would contribute to sending medical personnel to Haiti. And it turned out to be a cruel hoax. It actually was the phone number of the Haitian consulate. And the people who passed that information along to their network were sorry that they did. So there's one other issue here, which is you may have been aware of Eli Pariser's recent book on the filter bubble about the way search engines customize their results so that more and more of us are seeing a more and more narrow view of what's out there. And a number of years ago, there's a professor by the name of Cass Sunstein, who's now at the White House, who wrote an article called The Daily We. Nicholas Negroponte, many years ago, wrote about the future newspaper called The Daily Me, when we'd be able to use the internet to roll our own news. And of course, we've been in that era for some time now, and his concern was that people would pay more and more attention to sources that they agree with, and less attention to a diversity of sources. So I think it's important when you're creating what is called a personal learning network that you find people whose intelligence and integrity you respect, but whose opinions you disagree with. And so that's what I mean by if nobody in your network regularly annoys you, then maybe you are in an echo chamber. And you know what? Sometimes people that you strongly disagree with are right, and sometimes you need to change your mind about that. So participation, trying to move fairly quickly through this. We would not be talking about the web if it wasn't for participation. If IBM or the U.S. government had said, go forth and create the web, it would still be grinding away at it. If you make it easy for people to put up their own websites, maybe a picture of their dog, link to some other websites, you get billions and billions of web pages in just a few months. So just a couple of examples of participation power. The Warner Brothers attorneys tried to shut down a fan site for Harry Potter, and Heather Lauver organized worldwide boycott of Warner Brothers that backed the lawyers off in a couple of days, so fast that they didn't realize she was 16 years old. Beth Harris, obscure blogger, obsessed with Diebold's voting machines. As I'm sure you all know, Diebold makes most of the voting machines that we use in this country, and the source code for those machines was secret. But Beth Harris found it was on an unprotected website on Diebold, and she copied the source code and published it, and she was not an obscure blogger for very long. She climbed that curve I'm going to show you, that power law curve, so that the less obscure bloggers passed that information along. A group of students at Swarthmore University put that up on their server. They were sued by Diebold, and the courts found in favor of the students. Wael Gonim, you may recognize this face as one of the young Egyptian activists who, among other things, used Facebook to organize the revolution. Mark Zuckerberg, 19, the Google twins in their very early 20s, created new industries, multi-billion-dollar companies in their dormitory rooms. I stress the youth of these examples simply to show that if you know how to participate, you know how to create a web page, you know how to use a blog or a wiki, you can wield real power, political power, economic power, cultural power. So I talk about a lot of different forms of participation in the book. I very quickly want to go through something that's been getting attention lately and I think is important, called curation, which no longer refers just to people who work in museums, but refers to people who make choices about the information that comes their way online and pick out of that stream of information that which they think is most worthwhile, add a little context to it, and pass that along to others. You know, there's no way that we can regulate the quality of information that people put online. If that had been the case, there would be no internet. What we need to do is develop ways of finding the good stuff. There's crap detection in terms of eliminating the bad stuff. But in order to get the good stuff to rise, we need to make judgments about what we think is important and pass those judgments along to others. So if you hear the term collective intelligence, I think curation is a great way to do that. We all need to make these decisions in order to turn the information that comes our way into knowledge that's useful to us and useful to others, as it turns out. And it's useful to others because the architecture of the internet enables us to make our personal decisions public. So it's in open source programming, it's called scratching an itch. If there's a new piece of hardware that's created and there's not a, like a printer, and there's not a software driver for it, and you write a new driver for it, then you should contribute to the public code. Not only is it a good citizenship, but it signals that you are someone worth cooperating with, and you also cultivate a team of people who, when they change that hardware, are going to help you change that software. They call it scratching an itch. You have to tag and bookmark and make choices for yourself anyway. The genius of the first curation tools, social bookmarking, was that at no additional cost, either financial or in terms of your time or attention, you can make those choices public, and they add up the way the links on the web add up to a valuable public resource. You want to establish a reputation as having expertise in a particular realm, then curate websites about that. Tell people, I've been through 100 websites today, here are the four or five worth paying attention to and why. And if they're interested and knowledgeable, they will begin to recognize you as an expert. So there's something called search engine optimization that companies use to make their websites more visible to people who are searching. Curation is like personal search engine optimization. If you are curating a particular topic, people who are looking for information on that topic are going to find you. You're sending out signals that are going to attract potential collaborators. And there's a whole notion of social capital, the capability of a group of people to get things done together without formal rules, laws, contracts, or institutions like government. We all use social capital all the time. If you want to learn how to cultivate the networks of trust and norms of reciprocity that undergird social capital, curation is a great way to do it. And if a sufficient number of people actively curate what they find, if they actively participate online, we end up with what Henry Jenkins has called participatory culture. And the idea here is that a person who thinks of herself as an active creator, even if it's just tagging or bookmarking something of part of the culture that people consume online, has a very different sense of herself as an active person. Someone who thinks of himself only as a consumer of culture that is created by others is a different kind of citizen. There are a jillion ways to participate. There's a new one every day. So, again, don't just consume, create. Architectures of participation is a term that Tim O'Reilly coined to describe the way the technical architecture of the internet enables people to make decisions that are not necessarily altruistic, in their self-interest, but which add up to something for everybody. So I'm sure that nobody thinks I'm making Google a better search engine, I'm increasing their stock value when they put a link on their blog, but in fact, aggregating those decisions and then using their secret formula on them is exactly how Google presents search to us. And you know, free search is a great public resource. Of course, it's not entirely free. We're paying attention, and enough people pay attention to those ads to make a lot of money for Google. Napster was another example. People downloading music, for the most part stealing music, were not stealing it from a central server. They were downloading it from other Napster users who were online at that moment. The architecture of Napster technically made the folder on your computer where you downloaded music open to anybody else who was on Napster at that moment. So this is a unprecedented case in which the act of consuming a resource provisions that resource. Cory Doctorow calls it sheep that shit grass. Curation is a lightweight form of collective intelligence. It's a great way to get started on that. Learn norms and boundaries of local cultures before participating. And crap detect thyself before broadcasting it. So collaboration, I'm going to move quickly through this. In the book, I get into a lot more detail. I've written books about this. There are so many genres of collaboration, so many ways that people can do things together online that they weren't able to do before. So Smart Moms, my last book about the ability of people using mobile phones and the internet to organize collective action, people they weren't able to organize before, at paces and in places they weren't able to organize before. This is a group of students in Chile. They call this the Penguin Revolution because public school students wear black and white and gray outfits there. They became incensed about the lack of public support, financial support for education. They chained the doors of their schools shut. They induced 700,000 Chileans to join them in the streets. They used YouTube, Microsoft Instant Messenger, and Photolog, which is kind of a Facebook-like service that was popular there. 15, 16, and 17-year-olds. Virtual communities, I wrote a book about this in 1993. It was a little bit hard to convince people that there was a reality to this kind of community back then. But today, you know, whether you're a gamer or you are a cancer patient, chances are that you are connecting with people somewhere in the world that you may never meet, but who provide to you many of the things that community is supposed to provide. Information that's useful to you, sense of emotional support when you need it, a sense of belonging. A lot of people put their computer power together voluntarily to do things that individual computers can't do. SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, sucks down signals from outer space, turns it into digital material. Thousands of volunteers download a screensaver. When your computer goes to sleep, it wakes up, it downloads some of this material, it looks for patterns. What's interesting to me is not that they found any messages from people in other galaxies, but they created the world's most powerful supercomputer, 19 trillion operations per second, just voluntarily. Now, of course, it's not just looking for life in outer space. If you want to help biomedical research, come up with a new cancer medication, understand the immune system, help combat HIV, understanding how proteins fold is very important. It's a complex problem in three-dimensional space that is computationally intractable. But if you get a lot of people to help with it, you can do what has been done recently. In fact, they've turned it into a game. If you go to stanford.folding.edu, you can help with this. If you have an Xbox, you can go to Fold It, which is a game for people to try to make teams that understand how proteins fold. And Fold It, a Fold It team just discovered important information about the protease enzyme. And if you know anybody who's on HIV medication, they're taking a protease inhibitor. This is important, useful information. Jim Gray was a computer scientist who took his sailboat out on San Francisco Bay a couple of years ago and did not come back that evening. His friends, because he was a computer scientist, they were able to get the latest photographs from NASA and Google. Microsoft engineers cut those into 500,000 smaller photographs. They had thousands of volunteers use Amazon's Mechanical Turk to search 3,500 square miles. They never found Jim Gray, but they put this machine together literally overnight. So crowdsourcing is not just about businesses. And collective intelligence, we don't have to talk about Wikipedia. Who would have believed a few years ago that a few thousand volunteers would create millions of articles in a couple of hundred languages for free? And cooperative learning. You're hearing a lot about this now, the massive online courses, people using P2PU, the School of Everything, Skillshare. There are dozens of sites that are enabling people to use the resources that are available online and the ability to communicate with each other, to learn together. So again, organisms cooperate as much as they compete. If you want to see my 18-minute version of this, you can look at my TED talk. But there's an old paradigm about the way humans and other organisms get things done. It's that competition is central. Hello, I turned this off. Uh-oh, I'm not going to take my coat off. There's really a new story that's emerging from new knowledge from biology to economics that shrinks this notion of competition, still important, but it's no longer all important, to make room for a lot of information about complex interdependencies. Actions climb the curve of engagement, starting with simple kinds of collaboration. People build up literacy about it and can collaborate in more elaborate ways. There's a wide variety of ways to participate in collaboration. as well as participation. Enable self-election. Instead of assigning people to do things, just let them pick what they want to do, and you get open source. You get the web. You get Wikipedia. People contribute for a lot of reasons. Stephen Weber at UC Berkeley surveyed people who contribute to open source and to Wikipedia. The number one reason for contributing to open source programming is to learn how to program. The second one was to meet others who are interested in programming. So it's social, enhancing reputation, which you can turn into money. Creating public goods, altruistic, is another one, but only one of the motivations. And casual conversation builds trust. So the last of the five literacies, I'm going to move through fairly quickly here, is network science. Is discovering things. I'm sure you've all heard the words small world, power law, and long tail. Understanding the ways the structure of networks constrain and enable the behavior of individuals is an essential survival skill today. A lot of social scientists have talked about issues for many years before the internet that become very important today. And this notion of social capital, of being able to get things done with other people. You understand bridging capital? That connects disparate people and different networks, and bonding capital that builds trust between those people and networks. The importance of reciprocity can enable you to cultivate and to harvest social capital in ways that people who don't know that can't. So social networks were studied, again, for decades before the internet. Understanding what sociologists know about strong social ties and weak social ties and portfolios of social ties. Understanding the way social media, viral media, and the network society works. These are all not rocket science. It's not even the multiplication tables. But they're little isolated pieces of knowledge from different disciplines. Put that together, and you've got some important capital to know how to do things online. We now have network publics that are changing the way governance works. And the interconnections between these are only beginning to be understood. So networks have structures that influence the way individuals behave. Having both strong and weak ties is important. If you are someone who has a lot of friends, quote friends, that may not be as useful as having many people who need to go through you to get to others. They call that centrality. Diverse networks are collectively smarter. Tom Malone at the Center for Collective Intelligence at the Sloan School at MIT has done a lot of empirical research on this. Having a large network or having a network full of really smart people, it's not as useful as having a network full of very different kinds of people. People who can bridge different networks fill what sociologists call structural holes, stand to benefit. And this is interesting. There's empirical research by Barry Wellman at the University of Toronto that shows that doing favors for others online is the best predictor of whether they're going to do favors for you. So the technologies and the media have not slowed down. They've gone into hyperdrive. And I suggest that if you want to keep up, don't keep your eye on the technologies, but on the literacies that they enable.
Our thanks to Howard for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Level California, and you're listening to NetSmart, How to Thrive Online, with Howard Ringgold. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. If you have questions, please raise your hand and wait until you have the microphone, and make sure to speak into the microphone as we are recording.
Thank you. A very good talk. Really enjoyed it. One thing I wanted to ask you about was clout scores, which people are becoming obsessed with at the moment. I presume you know about clout scores?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I was just wondering whether you saw them as being something that was like inherently playing to people's kind of narcissism, or a useful tool whereby people could really determine their influence.
Well, you know, I don't think it's binary. I think that there's a spectrum, and I think it's a little bit closer to the narcissism side of it than the actual scientific measurement of influence. It's a beginning. If you had seen search engines when they started, They were pretty interesting, but they weren't really very good compared to what they are now. So I won't discount the possibility of developing ways of really measuring what people's influence are, but I think it's a lot more complicated than the sum of your Facebook friends plus your Twitter followers plus the number of retweets you get. I think it's a really good business model that if they can convince enterprises that what they're measuring is real, then they can make real money at it. I'm not convinced that there's a lot of science behind it.
We'll take next question.
Hi. Zay Frank recently compared Facebook to a crack pipe. And I'm just wondering, you talk about mindfulness. I love the idea of putting some goals down on the periphery of your vision during the day. Anything else you can share that would mitigate that kind of effect?
Well, I love Zay Frank. He's very, very funny. I would make a distinction. I don't think that you really get a lot out of crack. I do think that people get things out of Facebook. It is addictive, absolutely. I know many people, many of my students who spend a lot of time on Facebook. They are connecting with other people, and they are learning things. And I'm a little bit sensitive about this because I was a going to the library addict when I was a kid, and doing that instead of playing basketball was looked down upon. And so I think twice before I judge. However, the way I think about it is that social media don't compel distraction, but they strongly afford it. And it is easy to spend more time than is useful and healthy for you on social media, without a doubt. And I think it's something that everybody needs to think about. So I'm not going to get extreme about it. I'm worried about extending the addiction model too far. There's some people who stand to make some money by putting internet addiction in the DSM, and I think there are a few people who have a really serious problem and they need to deal with it. But I think for the most part, what we need to deal with is evaluating our attention and how much we're putting into other people and how much we're just fooling around.
What about the concentration of power in social media? I mean, power corrupts, that's the given. So giving businesses the kind of power that they're increasingly having, more power in fewer hands than ever because of technology, is that not a source of concern?
Absolutely. Are we going to maintain an open internet, or is Facebook going to enclose it? It's a really serious question. I'm much more concerned about Facebook succeeding at what AOL failed to do, which is to create a private version of the internet, than I am about Facebook addiction. Facebook addiction is going to become very serious when that's the only source of connecting with people online. So, Tim Berners-Lee, I think, in the last couple of weeks has really called for people to be alert to that. And, there are a lot of ways that the open internet can be enclosed. This business about net neutrality, the extension of copyright laws, these are political battles over control of what was uncontrolled. And I think that the feeling that the internet has always been out of control and it can't be controlled, we've learned. We've learned in Iran, we've learned in China, and we're learning in the USA that it can be controlled. And it's not just about concentration of power over what you pay attention to. There's there's a great article in the recent Wired magazine about this new center that the NSA is building in Utah. The amount of information about us that the state is acquiring is much, much larger than the amount of information that companies who want to sell us things are acquiring. So I think it's really important to pay attention. I do think there are dangers, real dangers.
Facebook has gotten really good in the last few years at delivering to us personalized information about our friends, and Twitter, personalized information about celebrities. But there's no equivalent in my perception to information that is interesting to us specifically, in the sense of academic papers that are interesting to me in my field. So where do you think will real, true, personalized news move in the next 5 to 10 years? How will we consume news in 10 years?
So I talked about curation. There are some great curation tools. There's Scoop It, Pearl Trees, Delicious. If you know how to find your way, and one of the things I talk about in the book is how do you find experts on a topic? How do you test their expertise? And how do you get harvest information and knowledge from them? How do you build a personal learning network? So it's not as easy as just logging into Facebook, but if you know how to use these, again, I think the critical uncertainty, the answer to the question, is this stuff any good for us? The reason I wrote the book is I believe the answer is it depends on who knows what. So if you really know, you can find expert information, you can get streams of knowledge, you can communicate with those experts. That knowledge is not widely taught to people. One more thing, since we're talking a lot about Facebook, Facebook keeps moving the line on what privacy means. You remember when the news feed became public? So when Facebook started, you could see what was on your friend's wall. But then they started publishing this news feed so that you could get it on your phone. You could just see a stream of information from your friends. It's not; these are people that you have friended. People were outraged. This was a violation of what they felt was privacy. And, of course, now it's accepted. It's part of what we consider to be public now. And so they keep moving the barrier. You know, privacy is a social construction, and Facebook in particular is changing how we view that social construction. And I think, you know, again, facts of life. A lot of people are afraid their kids are going to find bad material. They're going to meet bad people. Those dangers are minuscule compared to the dangers of cutting your kid loose on the internet without them knowing how to find their way, how to find the good information and separate it from the bad information, and where to find those privacy controls on Facebook, and why you might not want to enable the facial recognition feature in photographs.
And we have a lot of questions, but we like to close at 7, and Howard is going to be available to field any additional questions you may have. And we do have book signing sessions, so if you're interested in purchasing your own copy. I'll take one last question. One last question.
Last Sunday, Sherry Turkle wrote an article in the New York Times, Conversation versus Connection. Do you have any opinion?
I certainly do, and I know Sherry Turkle. I wrote the first interview with Sherry Turkle on the internet. I did for the first issue of Salon Magazine many years ago, and I respect her work a great deal because it is empirical. It's not a broad sample. She interviews individuals, and she makes two arguments in this op-ed piece last Sunday. One is that it's important for us to reclaim our solitude, and that a lot is lost when you don't have solitude. And I absolutely agree with that, and I have my own methods for doing it. And I suggest to everybody that they have a daily way of unplugging and being alone. And then she has this argument that I feel is totally specious about we've lost the art of conversation. This echoes many of the kind of pastoral nostalgia for something that used to exist and was good and true, but somehow, you know, this all happened when people started moving to cities from farms, when industry and industrialization and modernity changed the way of life in Europe in the 19th century. Sociology basically started as an argument over whether did we have Gemeinschaft, this kind of very organic kind of social relationship, or was it turning into Gesellschaft, this kind of structured contractual relationship? And this argument goes back a long ways, and I don't think that people had deeper conversations before the internet necessarily, and I think that people have conversations online. So I don't buy that argument that we've lost the art of conversation. I think if you listen to all of the other things that I've said and that I write about in the book, including talking about Sherry Turkle, one of the important things she says is that you need to be careful about the way you use social media in front of your children. And I compare it to secondhand smoke. That, you know, when you are looking at your BlackBerry while your child is trying to get your attention, you are teaching them something. You're teaching them something about your value, their value to you, and you're also teaching them something about the norms of how to behave. So I think it's really important to pay attention to what she writes about in Alone Together, but I don't agree with that article. I think you should cut half of the argument off and go back to the Thoreau argument. Also said, you know, someone made a, maybe this is snarky, they made a snarky remark. They said, anybody who uses the word summer as a verb really shouldn't generalize about the human race. She talked about summering on Cape Cod.
Thank you. Actually, Sherry Turkle was here maybe a couple of years ago, and she talked about her book, Alone Together. So it's on the web if you'd like to listen to that program. Okay. Well, our thanks to Howard for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.